Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today I have one of my favorite people on. I feel so happy when she comes on because it's like talking to somebody who gets it, an old friend, but someone who can speak knowledge, you know, with knowledge about how this healthcare system is, I don't know if it's working. It's not working for doctors and patients, let's be honest, but it's working for somebody because it keeps doubling down on the worst aspects of our healthcare system. Today, we're going to speak with Dr. Marilyn Singleton, and she's a gem. One, because she's an awesome person, but two, because she has a facility with not only being a medical doctor, but also understanding the law, as she has a JD degree. And we're going to talk about insurance today, health insurance. It gets a pass, I think too much so, because to me, it's one of the drivers of why our system is so bad. And nobody seems to be able to rein them in. I've gone to Congress, I've gone to the Department of Labor, I've gone to my insurance commissioner, I've gone everywhere, and I've yet to be satisfied as a physician and an advocate for my patient on how, you know, they're paying for a service they're not getting, and we're actually on the hook for things, and I'm just done with it. So I wanted Dr. Singleton to come on today and give us her take on why our healthcare system is the way it is, how the insurance companies got to be so huge, and what we as doctors and patients can do about it. So Marilyn, thank you so much for joining me today. I feel like I just need to have an old-fashioned powwow with someone who gets it so I can get it out.
Well, thank you for having me on the show and that great introduction. I should just quit while I'm ahead. My goodness. Let's just talk about paying for health stuff, paying for things in the community. If you go all the way back to our early settlers, they took care of each other. And of course, we didn't have MRI machines and fancy hospitals and all these other things to pay for, but they did have doctors and they did have nurse midwives and things like that that needed paying, but the community paid for it. And so that's kind of how people did early insurance. But then when the Industrial Revolution came in, people started getting injured. So there were all these on-the-job injuries. So they definitely needed doctors. And the companies just said, okay, we'll take a little bit of money out of everybody's paycheck, and that would pay for the doctor. And they usually had a doctor on site. You can imagine in the old days that people were getting injured all the time. So that was sort of the early insurance, certainly made sense. And it's kind of the embryonic present day workers' comp. But then it was like everybody else needed to have insurance. So during the Depression, the Great Depression, 1929, some teachers at Baylor in Dallas had a group plan. What they did was contract with a nearby hospital, and for a monthly fee, they would get all the care they needed. Now, at the time, it was 50 cents a month. Oh, would that it was that now.
Yeah.
So everybody was happy because the people knew that they'd already paid into something, and the hospital knew that they'd get paid. And so a lot of other hospitals thought, this is a good idea. So more and more did it. And thus, we had the modern day insurance system. The thing that's interesting, there were lots of companies that offered insurance once we had the so-called indemnity insurance, where somebody would do a service, then they'd submit a bill, and then they'd get paid whatever the bill was for the service. There were about 900 insurance products out there. Now, there's just a handful. And you know, all the monopolies and everything make it so there's not that many companies out there offering. Therefore, the prices continue to be high. But the real problem came in World War II. There is a wage price freeze. So in order to get new employees, the employers offered health insurance. And that was the benefit instead of higher pay. And that's when Blue Cross came into the picture in a really big way. So this covered emergencies and hospitalizations. And it's kind of interesting because that's what most people thought of, that that's what insurance should be for, emergencies and these huge bills that there's no way you could pay. Because certainly by the 40s, we had lots of hospital things. We had x-rays and EKGs and all these things that suddenly started costing money. But people still paid the doctor out of their own pocket. But then as time went on, it just ballooned. And so insurance was paying for everything, even day-to-day stuff. So you can imagine that if your car insurance paid for your gas, paid for your tune-up, how expensive the car insurance would be. And that's exactly how health insurance is now. It completely moved away from the original concept of protecting against a big risk. I mean, the whole idea of insurance, when it started back with Lloyd's, somebody, and the reason it was Lloyd's, there was a bar where people sat around, and when ships started crossing the ocean, they'd guess, is that ship going to sink or is it not going to sink with all the goods that were on board? So it kind of started off as betting, but then somebody got the idea that they just insure the ships, and people would get these chits and they'd say, okay, you know, give me 200 on that ship, or, you know, however amount of money they wanted to give. And that's how they had the pool of money. So you get a pool of money from a lot of people to pay for a big risk. But if you're paying for everything, what if they had to pay for every crossing of the ship across the ocean? There wouldn't be any money in the pot left. So that's what happened to health insurance. Hopefully that wasn't too blah, blah, blah.
No, not blah, blah, blah at all. But two things strike me about what you said. Initially, it seems like it was a one-to-one, right? The people got together and paid the doctor. There was no middleman. There didn't seem to be anything in between that could siphon money away and didn't have, a peculiar interest in not paying out because they wanted to make money. It's for profit. People don't really consider the insurance companies as profit-making entities. They have this earthy, crunchy, sweet little commercials about how they love the patients, but they actually love money more. And there's nothing that I can see that reins that in. It's a conflict of interest, isn't it?
In a sense, it's interesting because in the law, there is a cause of action against insurance companies. And there's something called first party bad faith and third party bad faith. When you think a claim hasn't been paid in bad faith. Now, most states these days have these appeals processes and all this kind of stuff if your insurance doesn't pay for something. But as we all know, if you go through this whole system and there's always some sad story about some poor creature who has cancer and the insurance doesn't pay, and even though ultimately they appeal, you know, like 2 years later, they decide to pay. And in the meantime, the family's gone bankrupt, even though they've paid their premiums, but they're not going to let their family member die of cancer just because the insurance company didn't pay. So there's certainly an effort not to pay. I took a course in law school called insurance law. And interestingly, not very many students were in the class. It was only about 30, maybe 35 people. And the teacher said he's always surprised that so few people signed up for it because insurance companies rule the world. And we really need to know how insurance worked. And he said that if you go to an insurance convention that, you know, they'll begin with a joke. And I think the company he used is Farmers Paid a Claim. And that was the big insurance joke. So they don't want to pay claims. They want to keep their money. And there's people sitting behind the curtain who calculate it all up and look at the risk and decide how much money they need. And they have something called reserves. And excuse me, that there's something interesting about reserves, that insurance companies have to have those to show they're solvent, and it's the amount of money they have on hand. And sometimes we'd get paid in bulk by certain insurance companies because they wanted their reserves to be high at the end of their fiscal year. Then the new fiscal year, then they dump the money and pay out. So here they were even manipulating the timing of payments. When managed care came out, the whole concept, it was trying to save money by managing our care and having gatekeepers who were going to say what you got, and you had to go to the primary care doctor first. And that certainly ended up costing more money, because if you needed a pap smear, go to the gynecologist and just get it done. Why do you have to pay once to go to the primary care who says, yes, you need a pap smear, and then go to the gynecologist? And fortunately, they've changed that where they consider a gynecologist a primary care, so they don't have to go through that gatekeeper. But they thought this managed care would lower their prices, but it didn't change anything to the prices, because that whole mentality didn't change. They were still paying for everything. And so there's certainly nothing wrong with making money. We all know that. You do a service, you make some money. But what's bothersome, and I think Dr. George hit it when you talked about these commercials where they're all sweetness and life and look like, oh, we'll pay you tomorrow with whatever you have. Don't hoodwink the customers.
Or the doctors, for that matter. You know, it's an interesting dynamic, because they have developed such a huge voice in the healthcare delivery system, and it's not based on medicine. Have you noticed that? I mean, we all, whether you're anesthesia, ENT, internal medicine, we all have boards or societies that give us what the standard of care should be. And it's well thought out most of the time, not just evidence-based, but it's at least has a point of reference to it. These guys get to totally ignore that. They just make it up. I don't understand how they decide that you, for example, need to be on antibiotics for 6 months before they'll pay for a CT scan. You know the person's not better after maybe one or two rounds, but the person is to suffer longer. And then you have to jump through a, you know, pre-certification hoop, et cetera. So my question, I guess, I don't know if you can answer this, but how do they make up their medically necessary? Because it's the most arbitrary thing, and it changes from year to year. A sinus surgery is a sinus surgery. A sinus infection is the same thing. Why do the parameters for all of these illnesses have to change?
What I find fascinating is you used giving antibiotics for months on end as an example, when we all know that you're not supposed to take antibiotics for a long time. And they wonder why everybody has antibiotic resistant germs now, because mm-hmm. people stay on them for too long. And what's really sad, and this used to happen with the whole gatekeeper thing in surgery, it used to be when somebody came in with a bowel obstruction, that they put in a tube where you put it through the nose and down in the stomach and then suck out the stomach content so it won't go through the bowel, since the bowel is obstructed. And if the obstruction didn't release itself, they go to surgery in 24 hours. Once the gatekeeper thing came in, they'd keep the tube in for 4 days. And we were like, if it's not de-obstructed, it's not going to on its own, and they need surgery. Consequently, what happened? The people were sick as dogs by the time they came to the operating room. They suddenly had to have more invasive IVs, something called central lines. They had to have arterial lines, all these extra things, because they sat around with them too long, because the gatekeeper was sitting on them. So all these rules that they come up with end up in the end hurting the patient and costing more money. If they just hit it with, like, get the sinus surgery, get it done, get them well, mm-hmm. then they'd end up paying less money.
You know, that's very interesting. I love how we can segue into the cost, because there have been, you know, when for us balloon sinus dilation came out, and it's a way to open up the sinuses without doing surgery in the OR. it's a much more cost-effective. It works this, you know, in terms of drainage, it actually helps the patient avoid surgery. It's a fraction of what it costs to go to the OR. It took years for the insurance companies to approve it. It made no sense to me. I thought your job was to save money, but there must be something else. Is there some sort of, again, a peculiar incentive that if it's the cost is high, they don't mind paying that. They don't mind having the person go to the ICU, et cetera, when they could have someone intervene earlier and fix the problem. Is there something in your opinion that leads them into, hey, let's cost as much as we can. We don't care how much it costs. What's the incentive to do that? Because they refuse to cover. You could call them up, talk to them, say, hey, it's a fraction of what, it's not 30,000, it's only like eight. Can we do it? No. I mean, they just wouldn't allow it. What do you think is behind that?
That is a huge question. I have looked at that and tried to figure out the incentive for why they would want to have higher bills. But higher bills would mean you get higher premiums. And when you get higher premiums, that's how they justify the high premiums. Look at these high bills. And remember, the high premiums come from everybody. They just don't come from that handful of patients who could have benefited from that surgery, who you dragged on for several months before you finally approved the quick and easy surgery. And so I just think it's a justification to charge everybody more. And the worst part of this, and this was busted in a lawsuit a few years back, and I believe it was Aetna. It could have been Blue Cross, so don't say I'm defaming, I'm guessing. But one of the major insurance companies, when the chief medical officer testified, he had to testify. He didn't even look at the people's appeal. It was a more ministerial staff that looked at it. And so if you don't even have a doctor looking at the patient's history and all this sort of thing, how can you even justify that you're telling the doctor who has the patient right in front of him or her, knowing what's wrong with the patient, knowing what's going to make the patient better, and then you send the appeal off to somebody who's not even a doctor? It makes no sense.
No. And from a medical legal standpoint, are these guys practicing medicine without a license? Do we have any leg to stand on if we use that argument?
People have tried, and I think there's a few cases where they win on that concept. Interestingly, so many times when you read the write-ups on cases like this, the insurance company is saying, well, this is industry standard, and they have boards that come up with these things and on, but the people who are on their board, just like the people who are on this FDA board, they are puppets. And remember when that Alzheimer's drug was approved by the FDA and it didn't work, and they knew it didn't work, but they still approved it? And I think it was something like three or four of the people on the board resigned. They were so appalled that they approved it. And I'm sure they must have known that some of their buddies were in cahoots with somebody to approve a drug that everybody knew didn't work.
It just seems so like a wild west, honestly, where it's really, honest. I've said it, and now you've just put it into words. It's not about healthcare. It can't be about healthcare if you put something on the market that you know either doesn't work or hurts people, and you do it anyway, knowingly. But there's there's nothing that happens to these people, no consequences. And let's take our first break, because I love to discuss that no consequence aspect of this, because that's, even to me, the most disgusting thing about this. The only people on the hook are the doctors and the patients. And I don't think it's a level playing field. So let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. And you can go to her website, MarilynSingletonMDJD.com. She has a podcast, on a platform called Living Out Loud. And you
America Out Loud.
I'm sorry. I'm going to live out loud too. Sorry.
America. I know. What is this? You're double dipping, Dr. George.
I'm tired of being muzzled. I'm sorry. I just had to let it hang out for a minute. Prior to the break, we were talking about practicing medicine without a license and having all of these entities, whether it's FDA, whether it's the drug companies, whether it's the hospitals, deciding what it means to give patient care and what doctors are allowed to do. And when it steps on the ability for the doctor to help their patient and have, in some instances, actively work against their patient, what can we do? I mean, there's no consequences, or do we not know how to use the system to work for us? What can we do to stop this?
I think part of it is not knowing how to use the system. I really wish that there were a regular job that was independent of the insurance companies that was a patient advocate. And every now and then, I'll be driving down the street and see a sign on a small office that says, we'll help you with your bills or something like that. I don't know what kind of business it is, but it always clicks with me because they say, we'll explain Medicare to you, which who on earth even understands Medicare? They've made that so complex. And patients need to know. One of the things that came out when there was the big story about artificial intelligence being used by Cigna to deny claims. Most people don't appeal the claims. The people who appealed, almost all the time they won. So what they were banking on is that people would not appeal. And we know that just from regular things. Look at items you buy at the store. Unless it costs a whole lot of money, you know, you paid a couple thou for some really nice TV and the thing didn't work, obviously you're going to take it back. But if you have a smaller item, you know, maybe even a container of printer ink or something, and your Walmart was far away, so it took you a while to get there, and the printer ink said it was supposed to last for 2,000 pages and it lasted for about 500 pages. Do you take it back? Do you argue? Because they will take it back, but they know most people won't follow up that way. So it's the same thing that happens with insurance. They don't pay, especially if it's a hospital. The hospital will send you some huge bill. Sometimes people know that all they have to do is go to the hospital and argue with them, and the hospital would rather get some money than no money, you know, so they'll lower the price. But people just don't know. I mean, that's why your show's so good. People are listening. They can learn and give it a try. And, you know, like they say, all they can say is no, but they usually don't say no. They count on people sucking it up.
That's a really good point. And, you know, not just the patients, but the doctors as well, right? And let's talk a bit. I know we're going to segue a little bit on this, but the healthcare delivery workforce has done 180. When you and I first came out, it was doctors doing everything, right? We rounded in the hospital. We took care of our patients when we admitted them. There was a real hands-on approach, and there was no hole that, you know, you send the patients in now, you don't know what happens with them. They don't call you. You can't get in touch with the doctor if you have a patient in there. God forbid you're a family member. It's just a black hole. And I don't remember ever, you and I were both residents. We had to talk to the family. They'd page us. We'd call them. There was family time, but we'd have conferences. I don't think that exists anymore. I think the patients go in there and they tell you what happens, what they're going to do to the patient. And then they're release, you don't even know the diagnosis sometimes. It's that much of an opaque system.
It really is. Remember when they added hospitalist in? At first, the internists were kind of, oh, I don't want somebody else taking care of my patient. Then it turned out to be pretty convenient. And you go in and the hospitalist takes care of you. obviously there's good sides to that. There's somebody who, you know, they're in the hospital 24/7 and you don't have to call them at home and have them drive in. And, you know, so you know that there's always a doctor there, but there's a certain disconnect in knowing the whole family's history. And when I mean that, I don't just mean the medical history. It's like, is there a rift between the kids and the parents? So you kind of know if somebody's saying, yeah, bump off grandpa, mm-hmm. that they're not doing it for nefarious reasons, you know, all these sorts of things. So when you know the patient and their family, you know how to counsel them in touchy situations. You know, do we operate on the 95-year-old lady? Do we not? You know, what are her wishes? And sometimes people haven't written down their wishes. So you really need to know the whole picture. And somebody who's only working in the hospital and isn't taking care of the patient on when they're well won't know all these things. So it makes it very difficult for everybody. And these days, I don't even know if the doctors like it. We know the patients don't necessarily like it. Sometimes it works out to their advantage, sometimes not. But what's the new number now, Dr. George? It's like up to 70% of doctors are either owned by somebody or work for somebody.
Exactly. Or they've sold their practice to some, you know, Wall Street system that's all about numbers, not about patient care. How many do you have to see a day? How many procedures do you have to do? We'll take care of it. We'll just pay you a salary, but you're basically working for somebody else. And again, it's not about the individual anymore. If we've gone, and I always use the term conveyor belt medicine, and I kind of did it tongue in cheek years ago, but in actuality, that's what it is. And, you know, these hospitalists, let's backtrack. Hospitalists are in the hospital, and that's one site. What about the doctor's offices? How many offices are run solely by mid-levels, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, not a doctor on site, but they'll call in or they'll review some charts. How do people get away with that? How do they even bill as if they're primary care when they're not MDs? So this whole system is just a money-making venture without regard to, in my opinion, quality. It's about quantity, and nobody really knows what's going on. Nobody's really holding the bag. But somebody's making a lot of money on this. And I that's not healthcare to me. I want us to be.
Oh, excuse me. Go ahead.
Oh, go. Please finish your thought. I'm so sorry.
No, I was saying when you talked about people who aren't physicians running practices by themselves, that this was touted as a way, one, to save money, and two, to bring care to people in rural areas and in what they call healthcare deserts. As it turns out, the mid-level caregivers are just like everybody else. They want to give care in the good parts of the city. So that part was kind of a joke. It's like, hey, Beverly Hills or San Bernardino County, I'll take Beverly Hills. And so that didn't pan out. Then they bill the same, so it didn't save any money. Now, hopefully there are people who do want to go to these healthcare deserts, and the government is trying to give more money to residencies where the person actually does the residency at a community hospital out in the country. And hopefully that person stays there. We have friends who are living in the country, and their doctor, interestingly, was in the public health service after she did her residency, and she was assigned to a prison that was on the outskirts of the town where she now practices. She fell in love with the town from working at the prison. And so people do stay in these areas. But putting people who didn't go to medical school out there by themselves, I don't know what good that does. So
that's a really good point. Let's take a next break, because this is such a complicated system, and it was created to be that way, to be just, to me, just a a ball of misinformation. And I don't know, if you make it so opaque, you can do whatever you want. Nobody can figure out where the problem is, so they can't fix it. So on that note, let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton, and we're having an honest conversation about our healthcare system. There's a lot of money in our healthcare system, isn't there, Marilyn? I mean, I remember a pie chart way back at the beginning before Obamacare, and they were talking about the healthcare dollar, and 7 cents of that dollar actually went to the doctor. Everything and its mother was taking money from the system, whether it was administrators, it was, you know, big pharma, it was the hospitals, it was everything except the people who matter. The system is supposed to be for doctors and patients and for healthcare practitioners, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that now. And it's, I think they used our egos against us and the nurses. And so I remember when the nurses were really up in arms about nursing and how they were doctors of nursing. And it was this movement towards not being an RN anymore, but being a case manager or some sort of administrator, where you were making a lot more money and you had more power in the say-so of how the hospital would work. But everybody who knew the most, who had the most life experience, who could see things and treat patients based on clinical knowledge, they all left. So we were left with the people with the least experience, with the least training on the front line. And like, that was going to be awesome. And it was going to be the same thing. And I think people fell into the trap, and those people were like, now I feel like a doctor because I have all this power. And it was just ridiculous. And so my question to you now is, how on earth did doctors put ourselves in this position? How do we let the system that we had caretakers for be completely removed from our auspice, from what we were able to provide?
I think so much of it became way back when they started a payment system called RVS system, where everything had a relative value. And people who worked in the operating room did have a higher relative value. Now, of course, surgeons and anesthesiologists have much higher malpractice, because if there's a mistake or a misadventure of some sort, whether it's your fault or not, the payout and the injury might be kind of big. Whereas usually in internal medicine, you might have a delayed diagnosis, or maybe don't give the right medication, but you start to notice the complications sooner. So the payout isn't as big. So the malpractice insurance premiums aren't as big. So there's kind of a reason that people who did procedures had a higher relative value. So then the people who were, as they called it, the cognitive specialties, wanted more money, or they were kind of foolish in the way they asked for more money. They said, we want the same money. So what do you think happened? Did they raise their money? No, they lowered the money of the procedure doctors. Yeah. But they got kind of this turf war and rift going. And I think it was very, who was the guy who wrote Art of War? Sun Tzu, where you get people kind of bickering amongst each other. And then behind the scenes, you're kind of sticking it to them all. And we let it happen. We got lazy. Then we got busy when the practices were bought up. So you're too busy to even fight the system. And now people coming out of medical school, this is all they see. One of the things that's interesting, just recently it came out that Walmart, who was going to disrupt the healthcare system with their clinics, is closing most all their clinics, and they might even close them all other than the vision clinics and pharmacies, because they couldn't make it work. And one of the things that kind of came out of that is people thought that if you did things on a big scale, as we know Walmart does, you can't do that with patient care. There's too many differences. Each patient isn't one of those schmatas you buy from China, where they just chunk them out all the same. All the patients are different. So whatever their model was, they weren't making any money. So they're closing all those off. And that was supposed to be the answer to people's dreams who lived away from urban centers where medical centers were.
Well, let me add a little piece to that little puzzle. They're closing about, I think, like 30 Walmart locations here in Georgia, right? It's, or maybe it's 50, it's a lot. And they just came on TV here. I just heard the news. And the reason why, what you just said, but their reimbursements were so low that they couldn't afford to keep their locations open. And the first thing I said sounds kind of, you know, cynical, but I'm like, welcome to our world. This is what we've been dealing with for in my whole practice, so in 20 some odd years in practice. Every year the reimbursements have gone down, but the cost of doing business has gone up. And I've made it work. Not easy, totally not easy, but this is the state of the healthcare system. They want to give you, I mean, they claim Cadillac care, but they're not paying for the cost of doing business, of providing quality care. We do it at a loss as a solo and as an independent practice, and we do it because we love it. But in actuality, this is not sustainable in any sense. So do you think it's by design? Do they want this to become a single payer so that you basically just, you're relegated to taking a salary? Because there's no way you could keep your doors open and run a practice and really do what you're supposed to do, take care of your patients. Is this really the biggest picture here?
I think the nail on the head there. You make life so miserable that it's like, please save me. I read a book several years ago after the Bernie Madoff scandal called No One Would Listen. And it was written by a stockbroker who figured out the algorithm that he was using to do his Ponzi scheme. But he was talking about his early life and how he got into math. And he said his father owned, I think it was Long John Silver's or, you know, one of these fast food places. And there's a number in fast food, and I believe it's 7%, that's the basic loss you're supposed to have, spoiled food, whatever. And when you notice that that loss is higher than that, then you guess that somebody's stealing. So his father guessed that somebody's stealing. So when he figured out who it was, he didn't just fire him because then his unemployment insurance rates would go up. He just gave him terrible hours so that he quit. And I think about that story when I see what's happening with medicine. You make it bad enough to be in solo practice, that of course it'll be like a savior. And then that's what they're teaching the medical students, that single payer is more equitable and more people would get care. But again, and you brought this up, what's care if it's not very good?
Exactly. And they can't afford to give the care. Who's paying for this single payer, right? Medicare is, I don't even know if it's solvent, to tell you the truth. You've got these advantage plans where you have the insurance companies being the, you know, I guess the caretaker, the moderator of the insurance plan. But none of it works. It's borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. The trust fund's gone. The Social Security's crazy. But everything's gotten more expensive. So how is this really supposed to work? I mean, it doesn't make short-term sense for sure, but it doesn't make long-term sense either. At some point, the whole thing has to give, doesn't it?
It does. And what you're stepping right into here is the R word, rationing. When you don't have a lot of resources, you've got to dole them out. And we've been trained really in our American ethic that all lives should matter, and that assuming you're not ready to die because you have terminal cancer and it's, you know, taken over your entire body and it's your time to go, that we treat everybody. And supposedly, not always true, we treat everybody the same. And I used to tell my patients after Jimmy Carter got melanoma, when he was in his 90s and he got the full court press, I said, you tell your doctor to treat you like they treated Jimmy Carter. And if they're going to do that for Jimmy Carter, they need to do it for everybody. But at some point, they're not going to do it for anybody. And we don't know when that point is. We don't know if they're going to start at the bottom, which is what they usually do. And frankly, I don't want to be there when that happens.
No, and I want to be a partner in facilitating that in any way. And for the doctors who are on salary or on staff, it seems to me they don't have a lot of power in saying, I want to try a different medicine. I want to give my patient every opportunity to get better. It seems that there's really, from an administrative standpoint, they saw the writing on the wall and they're implementing it, but they're making it comfort care and they're making it, you know, what do you call it, palliative care and all these other things, but they're just withdrawing care from people. I think Canada's gone totally left with this, with their, you know, healthy people being, you know, euthanized and making it sound like it's the best thing in the world. I mean, it's not healthcare. I don't even understand how doctors in any part of our world would allow this and would be a partner to this and would actually implement it. It's shocking to me.
Do you remember Ezekiel Emanuel? He was Obama's health advisor. He had this thing called, what was it? The
Complete Live System.
Complete Live System. Thank you. And he had a whole system which came out that adolescents and young adults were to be given the care first, babies and old people last, because they were least useful to society. It's like, okay.
And you know, the sad part, you know, this didn't at all apply to him because he's going to pay for whatever he wants. And it's a two-tier system where those, you know, like, Animal Farm? Some people are more equal than others.
Exactly.
And everybody is all looking left, you know, at equity and inclusion and DEI. But in actuality, it means dropping the floor for everybody. And you won't know until you're in it. And then it's too late, isn't it?
That's right. It reminds me so much of when they talk about these tax cuts and stuff. You know, first it was only we'll tax the rich. Of course, nobody defined what rich was. And then it's nobody making under 400,000. What they forget to say, they're not talking about a single person making 400,000. They're talking about a family making 400,000, which, believe me, in California doesn't take you that far. And so that wouldn't be considered rich. I mean, obviously it's a lot of money, but you wouldn't call that rich when that's the income of the whole family, not just one person. And so once you get it in place, okay, it's only going to be for people with 400,000. Suddenly, the next time you see the law, it's dropped down to 325,000. Then it's dropped down to 250,000. Then pretty soon it includes everybody.
Exactly right.
You know, and that's the same thing that's happened. It's already happening in healthcare. People, there was some state, I don't remember which one, that recently there was a big hubbub because the large hospital in the state changed their whole insurance system. And half the patients lost their doctors. The doctors were on contract with somebody else and they had no other alternative. So no more picking your doctor. You take who you can get, which fortunately most people are competent, but there's more to medicine than just the competence. You like to have somebody that you click with, that you connect with. And, you know, they talk about patient adherence or patient compliance. That's, you know, a patient doing what you've asked them to do. Well, they're more likely to do what you ask them to do if they like you. As simple-minded as that sounds, it's true.
I couldn't have said it better. On that note, let's take our last break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. And Marilyn, when does your podcast run? How can people listen to it?
My podcast, it's live on Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern, and it's americaoutloud.news/pulse. And it's a different doctor every night, so I'm on Monday. And then in 24 hours, it comes on podcast, where you can go to the website, just click on my name, and you can look at other people's as well. Obviously, you know, they'll come out. And they're interesting topics, and the format, with it being a different doctor every night of the week, everybody kind of has their own thing and talks about different things. So people don't get bored. And the medical aspects, they even have another show called Nurses Out Loud that's on Monday mornings at 10. So there's a lot of things for people to listen to about healthcare. And I think now's the time for people to start listening, because the elections are coming up and everybody's going to say, well, we're going to do this or we're going to do that. And it's so important for people to know what it means. It was like when Obamacare, and you wrote that wonderful book about Obamacare and kind of ticking it apart, that you can't tell people we're going to pay for everything and make everybody pay for everything. Why should a single 50-year-old man, whether he's gay or straight, have to pay a higher premium to pay for pregnancy when he has no intention of getting anybody pregnant? So it raises everybody's premium to serve a few people who are actually going to use that benefit. And believe me, you want people's pregnancy to be paid for, and now they want universal payment for fertility treatments. And that's certainly a touchy subject. Some people say, is there a right to have kids? Is there not a right? Is it, a luxury and all this? You know, so there's a lot of contention about whether everybody should pay for fertility treatments. Maybe we should just lower the price of fertility treatments, because they've been around long enough that we know the technology has come down in price. So I don't know why it still should be so expensive.
You make an excellent point. And, you know, the system is, we've just described how it's going off a cliff. And, you know, I made the comment of, why would doctors want to be involved with this? I'm seeing another side of this, potentially. Haven't you heard of all of this? Oh, we have a doctor shortage. We don't have enough people. And now we have to somehow add AI, add robotic medicine, robots doing things. Is that another endpoint that they could move to? You don't have to pay a robot. You don't have to use AI for medical decision. You don't have to go to medical school for X number of years, right? You don't have to be a surgeon. You can have a robot do the surgery. That's a way to take humans out of it. Take individual healthcare out of it, take the humanity out of healthcare, because an AI would have no problem pulling a plug, will it? Versus a human who sits there and actually has empathy. You can't program empathy, can you?
Absolutely not. It's interesting you bring this up with replacing people with robots. Out here in California, we recently put into practice a law that was passed a while back giving fast food workers, with some exceptions for Gavin Newsom's friends, $20 an hour. Well, guess what happened? There's already several McDonald's who have replaced the people, except for a couple of people in the store now, with kiosks that you just punch in your order. And, some poor schnook behind the heat lamps has the hamburgers there. And then now they even have robots that bring it out. That's what happens when you start messing with things and kind of messing with the natural order of things. So it can certainly happen in medicine.
once that bridge is crossed, I don't know how you get it back. And you described how the training of our doctors has changed. I think the people going into medicine have changed as well. They don't have a facility with patient care. It's all about algorithms and looking at your iPad and not the person. That's exactly the opposite of where we should be. And we have time, don't we? I mean, yes, it's getting short in terms of it moving quickly, but we can withdraw our consent, can't we? Can't we decide as physicians, we're not going to be part of this. We're going to open up our own shingle. Maybe we don't want to take insurance. Maybe we want to do cash pay so that we can keep the costs low, that patients have skin in the game. And when they pay out of pocket, they're a lot more, amenable to being a partner in their care than having somebody else pay for it. Don't you think?
Absolutely. We need to go back to where insurance was for these massive hospital bills. And think about it, everybody. Most people don't really get sick. You know, you go through your whole life and maybe the only time you're in the hospital is to have a baby. But most people don't end up with some huge thing that happens to them in the hospital. If it's an auto accident, your auto insurance can pay for some of it if you didn't have health insurance. But most people aren't in massive auto accidents either. So the number of people that actually go in the hospital is smaller than they want you to think. And if those pooled resources went to paying the huge hospital bills and then private monies paid for the day-to-day care, which we all know for people who have cash practices can be half, sometimes as low as one third the cost of if you're using your insurance to pay. So there needs to be a whole reworking of the system. But I just don't know if it's going to happen because the trainees are being trained differently. And don't get us wrong, AI has usefulness. Just as our computers have usefulness, but the computer is only as good as the information that goes into it. And just like AI, it's only as good as the doctor who's managing it. But these young kids who now they're not young kids anymore, but they're raised in the generation where all they're doing is looking at their telephone and texting and all this. It's a completely different mindset. And call me an old fogey, but it's not a mindset that I like.
No, I don't want to be on the receiving end of that when they decide, oh, you're too old, you lived a useful life and you should be happy to give away to the younger people. That's the mindset. They don't have any, it's a kind of a huge statement, but there's some people out there who don't respect any seniors, you know, wisdom, people who have a lot to offer still in this world. It's like you put out to pasture just by definition, because you've reached a certain age and you're in the way and you're taking it from somebody else. That's to me is the thing that really strikes me is that there's always this feeling of lack. Because you have something, you took it from me. I can't achieve because you're in my way. Therefore, you need to be removed with extreme prejudice. You know what I mean?
Right. That's a zero sum game they make it, you know, exactly. Rather than win-win.
And
we have to use the resources judiciously. And that's why patients have to be involved. Don't be silly. Don't go to the ER for a cold and many other things. You know, you have a small cut on the tip of your finger. No, wash it off really well and put a Band-Aid on it. And, you know, just cool your jets. The hard part is I think there's not enough basic health education. They're so busy with all the sex education, they need to do some basic health education to help people differentiate when you should go to urgent care, when you should go to the emergency room, when you should just plain stay home.
I think common sense needs to rule again. It seems like common sense and critical thinking have been totally removed from our world, it seems like. And it's up to adults here to take our power back, right? As physicians, maybe we should start taking the time to educate our patients. And I think you're right. There is some degree of laziness and maybe learned helplessness. And it's not such a big system that you can never win. I think we've been educated in feeling that it's too big. Nothing that we do will make a difference. And that has to change. If we can just get to the point of I make a difference, everything I do is either going to help the system, help it improve, or if it's a lost cause, I need to do something else from a healthcare perspective. Do you think that that could make a difference?
It's that, how do they say, you have to take one step to start the 100-mile journey. And I just think we've been so cowed, and we have to throw in the student debt that's out there. So, and people in the old days, people didn't have families until they started their practice. Now people start to have families while they're still residents, so they have a family to support. So so many things in society have changed. And so it's a bigger problem as Walmart and some of these other places have figured out. It's not as simple as it seems because there's so many factors that go into it. But it brings us full circle.
I just want to thank you so much for joining me today. So, you know, time goes too fast always, but I think we did a good job of giving people some sort of background and a facility on, they know something's wrong, but you're right if you think there is something wrong. And this, what we talked about, are ways that you can pick up, you know, the baton and move towards a healthcare system that you create that's going to work for you and your family. So I want to thank you again for joining me. I can't wait to have you back. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.